All right, well, let's go ahead and open in prayer, and then we'll jump in. Dear Lord, we thank you for this evening. We thank you for another just amazing day that you've given us, Lord. So many blessings. And we thank you for the opportunity to dig deep into your word, and what a privilege that is just to spend time with you and to get to know you better. And we thank you for this opportunity, and please help us to take advantage of it and seek to grow closer to you because of it. We love you and we praise you. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, like I said, we are quickly coming to the end of Daniel. Last week we entered into the final section, which includes chapters 10 through 12. Chapter 10 is the introduction to the final vision that Daniel is given at the end of his life regarding the future of his people. Chapters 11 and 12 then lay out the details of that vision. So last time we journeyed through chapter 10 and discovered an amazing revelation. What we found is a description really of another reality, a hidden reality that exists all around us but is invisible to the naked eye. And this is the realm in which we find spiritual warfare happening. So we explored what spiritual warfare is all about. We took a look at several passages that give us glimpses behind the curtain and show us that even though we can't see what's going on, there is a battle raging all the time that the book of Ephesians tells us is the battle that we are all engaged in. The message of Ephesians 6 is that what we do in this realm actually has an effect on that realm. Otherwise, why would God have given us armor for this spiritual battle? So we discussed how Daniel was praying and fasting for 3 weeks, and while God had sent the answer to his prayer right at the moment he started, that the answer to his prayer was delayed for 3 weeks by this spiritual warfare. And so we asked the question as to whether or not the fervency of Daniel's prayer had any effect on that spiritual battle. In other words, if Daniel had ceased praying and fasting before the end of those 3 weeks, would the answer have gotten through? So we honestly don't know, but the possibility is left open by this passage. So this angel, with God's answer, had spent 3 weeks fighting the prince or the demon ruler behind the kingdom of Persia. And it's only when the archangel Michael comes to help relieve him that the angel arrived with the answer to Daniel's prayer. We discussed also the possible implications of this chapter, how there appear to be different ranks of angels. They seem to have particular assignments in terms of territory and job description. We talked about the different descriptions of angels and angelic beings in the Bible, the cherubim and the seraphim, and how Satan was probably the highest of all the cherubim. And then we discussed the practical ramifications for us in terms of spiritual warfare in our lives. Ephesians 6 describes the armor that God has provided for us to engage in this battle. And we so often just get caught up in the mundane trivialities of this life that we forget that this life really is a prelude to and preparation for something so much bigger. And that what we do in the here and now really does have ramifications and consequences that will reverberate throughout eternity. I think we see that a little bit in the spiritual warfare. We are literally eternal beings, and the choices we make in the here and now affect us in the age to come. And that's literally mind-blowing to think about. Especially in terms of how we invest our time, our talents, and our treasure. I think investing is a really key idea to think about. But the point is that there is a crossover between that realm and this realm. And it's in the spirit realm of spiritual warfare that we see that crossover. So chapter 10 gave us a peek into that realm. And it introduces the the scenario that God has given us in this final vision and who is involved. The angel has come to Daniel with an answer from God, and we saw we stopped at the end of chapter 10, but chapter 11, verse 1 might have been a better place to stop because it gives us a little bit more information about this message. So in chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him." It says there that in the first year of Darius, that he, the angel, arose to be an encouragement for Darius. So this angel was assigned on behalf of God to serve and protect this pagan king, Darius. So perhaps we actually only saw half the picture last time. What I mean by that is we saw that how on the one side there is this demonic personage called the Prince of the Kingdom of Persia, who is doing battle on behalf of Satan, and working behind the scenes, providing influence on Satan's behalf, and he is assigned to the Kingdom of Persia. And then after him, the same angel that God sends is going to be fighting the Prince of the Kingdom of Greece, another demon ruler behind that power. And we saw that this angel had to get through these defenses before he could get to Daniel with this answer. And it's kind of like the angelic forces are in heaven, and that Satan, as the king of the world, has all these defenses arrayed around that surrounding and influencing all these nations in his realm. But what if these nations, all of these nations, in addition to having a demonic force assigned to it, also have an angelic warrior assigned to it as well, whose job it is to fight on behalf of God against these demonic forces? We only really discussed this, the idea that God sends his angels on missions and that they are confronted with demonic opposition. But what if this is much more two-sided, that every nation or kingdom has forces from both sides constantly fighting for supremacy of influence? And I think that's a hint we can see here in verse 1, and I think that seems to make a lot of sense. So in verse 1 it says that this angel's job was to encourage and protect Darius in the first year of Darius. So he's right there at the beginning of Darius' reign. God assigns an angel to fight for God's priorities against the demonic forces on the other side. Again, we don't have a lot of information here, but it seems like these territorial spirits perhaps can apply to both the good and evil sides of the battle. So this verse, verse 1, really ends the introduction to the message. Again, the message comes in chapters 11 and 12. Verse 2 then will begin to lay out the message itself. And there's so much information here in this chapter about the details and intricacies of the history of this period that I think it'd be good if we can step back and take an overview, I guess, at first to help it make some sense. I don't know about you, but growing up in church, the period between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament was always described as the 400 silent years. Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Well, again, the end of the Old Testament was right around 400 BC with the last book, the Italian prophet Malachi. Sorry. And then everyone says God went silent, right? For 400 years, there was nothing until the New Testament begins with John the Baptist. But what we're going to see here is that this idea of the silent years couldn't be farther from the truth. God describes for Daniel in great detail precisely what happens during this period. Chapter 11 is so detailed, and like I've said many times before, that this is why liberal scholars, and this chapter in particular, is why liberal scholars have to late date Daniel, because they can't explain how he can know so much detail about this time period. So we saw the same period back in chapter 8, when the ram and the goat were idioms used for the kingdoms of Persia and Greece. And in chapter 8, we saw how the ram of Persia was really only briefly mentioned. simply as a way to set up the rise of Greece, the nation that would affect Israel so much more. So here too, in chapter 11, Persia is introduced in just the first couple of verses, and really is only mentioned in passing so we can get more quickly to the exploits of Greece, especially two particular branches of Greece after it split following the death of Alexander. And then we'll see how these two regions interact with each other, using Israel really as the battleground in between them, the buffer state. So just to review a bit of the history, in chapter 8, we read, verse 3, it says, "Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last." And so we saw how this was a picture of Medo-Persia, with Persia being the longer horn, which is more prominent and came up later. Verse 4, it says, "I saw the ram budding westward, northward, and southward, and no other beasts could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself." So here, with their 2.5 million man army, the mighty King Xerxes of Persia was absolutely unstoppable. But he made the mistake of attacking a nation in the west that was on the rise, and this was Greece. And even though he didn't conquer them, he so enraged them that they never forgot it. Verse 5 says, "While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes." So here the male goat, under the command of Alexander, Greece just flew across the ground and conquered the known world in a very short amount of time. Verse 6 says, "He came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. And he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. And in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven." So after the death of Alexander, his massive empire was divided between his four generals, the two most prominent being Ptolemy in the south and then Seleucus to the north and east. And this will be the focus of much of this chapter, is the interaction between the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire, these two branches of the Greek Empire. But the important takeaway to get from chapter 8 was how this rather small horn, which we saw was Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the rulers of the Seleucid Empire, how he previewed for us the career and the exploits of this coming world leader, the Antichrist. God was preparing his people for this upcoming period of devastation under Antiochus by giving Daniel this vision, by telling them in advance what would happen so they wouldn't be taken by surprise. But then we also saw how this period of devastation was a preview of the end of days when the Antichrist would do something similar, but much more intense. But so here in chapter 11, we're going to see even more detail about that same period coming shortly for Daniel and his people, where the Seleucids and the Ptolemies are battling between them. And then we're going to also see more parallels to the scenario that will unfold in the end times as well. God is giving his people, who will be alive at the end times, during the tribulation period, a measure of preparation as well. God always prepares us for what is to come. And that seems to be the purpose of this vision. Yeah.
So, about what time in history is
he is right at the very end of his life. So, just a couple years into the Persian Empire. So, about 535-ish, something like that. Around there somewhere. So, they had been in Babylon for 70 years. That just ended. Persia, Medo-Persia came in, and that's the end of Daniel's life. And he's writing this about really the end of the Persian Empire and the beginning of the Greek Empire. So a couple of hundred years hence from him. So here in chapter 11, there also seems to be a particular focus which I think was going to come into view. And that's namely that even though all this strife and turmoil that's upcoming will look like the end, that it is not yet the end. And we're going to also see this, that this chapter can be divided up into four sections or four movements, and the last of which will be describing the time of the end. So keeping in mind this idea of four movements, we see here in chapter 11 that after, again, just an initial mention of Persia and really just the end of the Persian Empire in verse 2, and then an introduction to Greece in verses 3 and 4, where, again, Greece is split up among Alexander's four generals. The rest of this passage and really the future is divided up into these four movements. So 11, 5 through 19, 20 through 28, 29 through 35, and then 36 through the beginning of chapter 12. And if we watch the terminology carefully, we'll see that only the last of these four periods really pertains to the time of the end. What we'll see is that Daniel's concern is that there would be people in the first three periods who would make the mistake of thinking that the time of the end had come. Because in the first three periods, we're going to see through a repetition of vocabulary and a repetition of situations that all four periods will look like the time of the end. All four periods will have features in common, such as the fact that a king will make an enormous attack on Egypt, and either on his way down or on his way back, he will set up his army stationed in Israel and either threaten to carry out a destruction of Israel or actually destroy Israel while he's there. But what Daniel wants his people to see is that while going through these first three periods, that they need to understand that it is not yet the end. This is something similar to what Jesus did in Matthew 24. And we've read this passage many times. I'm going to just read through part of it real quick for you. Again, he describes the scenario all for the purpose of telling us that this is not yet the end. So he says, "And Jesus answered and said to them, 'See to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time, many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. The gospel of this kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come.'" So Jesus says that all of these events, and these the famines and the wars and the persecutions and earthquakes, all that will mislead many into thinking that the end has come. So the purpose of this chapter seems to be the same thing that Jesus was warning about. So in period one, starting in in 5 through 19, just as an overview, the angel warns Daniel that the Seleucid king, Antiochus III, who we're going to learn more about in this chapter, and we also talked about him in chapter 8. This isn't Antiochus Epiphanes. This is Antiochus III, Antiochus Epiphanes' father. So while he occupied Israel, Daniel's going to show us that some violent Jews would rebel in fulfillment of the vision, verse 14, but they would fall. Presumably, they would be under the impression that the end was near. Then in period 2, 20 through 28, there would come a time when the cruel king of the north, and that's going to refer to Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, he would sit at the negotiating table with the king of the south, and they would scheme together about doing evil. But the angel points out here that Daniel, that their plans would come to nothing, for the end is still yet to come. And that would be at the time appointed. It says that in verse 27. Again, we can infer here that there's a warning against mistakenly thinking that even though this appears like it's the end, it's not yet the end. And Israel's caught in the middle of the suffering and this horrible harassment. Again, but it's not yet the end. Then in period 3, in 11, 29 through 35, Daniel is told that the king of the north, again, this is still going to be Antiochus Epiphanes, who was enraged by the Roman imposed limitation of his power in Egypt. And we're going to get into the great detail about that. That because of that rage, he would take out his anger against the Jews who refused to go along with the Hellenization of the imposition of Greek culture on their land. And he would do this by committing the ultimate insult against Israel and preview for us the abomination of desolations. We already discussed how Antiochus persecuted and slaughtered the Jews. He made Torah reading illegal. He put an end to sacrifice in the temple. He erected an idol to Zeus in the temple and sacrificed a pig on the altar. And all of this outrage then led to the Maccabean revolt, which we talked about. As horrific as this time was, and even though this might seem like the end, Daniel is telling them this is really just a preview of the end. It's not yet the end. So as we go through this, don't try not to get lost in the details, because there are a lot of details we're going to have to sort of slug our way through. So just keep in mind these four sections and what the overall message is. Okay, so then there's going to be this fourth period, and the king will in this section the king will come to his end. Okay, and this will lead in the beginning of chapter 12 to a description of the resurrection of the dead and the end times, and then a timetable is given for all this. And again, what did we learn about the purpose of this kind of revelation with a timetable given? It's to give the people hope that their suffering is coming to an end. So this fourth period is going to be different than the first three periods in that the end will actually come, and the description of the establishment of the kingdom will then be described all throughout the rest of chapter 12. So with that sort of preview in mind, let's try to make our way through the chapter 11. Again, try not to get bogged down by the incredible precision and the detail with which Daniel describes the period of these Seleucid kings. But what we will do is try to describe some of the history surrounding it, so all this descriptive language makes a little sense. So like I mentioned, what we have here in the beginning of chapter 11 is just a short section which gives us a summary of the end of the Persian era. And just like in chapter 8, the kingdom of Persia, again, is only mentioned as a segue to get to the nation that's really in focus, namely Greece. So the angel here continues on in verse 2. It says, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to rise in Persia. And then a fourth..." Okay, we started in verse 1 where he mentioned Darius, right? And then actually Cyrus is the king when he is given this vision. So verse 2 says, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. So three more kings did arise after Cyrus. And you see that little chart there. And you can see the verses on the left-hand side, verse 2, 2, 2, 2, and then 3 and 4 down at the bottom. Those are the kings that are in focus here. So these three kings that came after Cyrus, they were Cambyses, the son of Cyrus. Then we get Pseudo-Smerdis, or false Smerdis, who was an imposter who impersonated the real Smerdis after he was killed by his brother Cambyses. Then comes Darius Hystaspes, also called Darius the First, who had married a daughter of Cyrus. And then the last one in view here is Xerxes. And the reason he is important is that he is the one who invades Greece and gets Greece all riled up against Persia. Yeah.
Is that supposed to be on here?
No, it's in your notes.
Okay.
Do you see it there? Find it?
Yep.
Okay. So yeah, that chart really, again, it's just to highlight those Persian rulers in chapter 11. Then at the bottom, it does list the four generals. Well, before that, it has Alexander the Great as it transitions to Greece, and then the four generals that it's split up into. So that's what that chart is. So the fourth ruler here, Xerxes, he was fabulously wealthy. This was the king that's called Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. And it says here that he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. The rest of the kings of Persia that come after him are not in view here in chapter 11, because it was Xerxes who was the most powerful. And he's the one who caused Greece to want to annihilate Persia. Then in verse 3, after briefly mentioning Persia, the transition is made to Greece and the arrival of Alexander. So verse 3, it says, "And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded. For his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides him." So after Alexander dies, his kingdom is divided up between his four generals. You can see that at the bottom of the chart. And it says here, not to his own descendants. All right, so that clearly came to pass. Alexander did not have any heirs for his kingdom to be passed to. The next section we come to is what we get. I just gave an overview of what we're going to see in the next section as four movements. Yeah. Xerxes, the fourth king.
So when you say, this is probably the dumb question for you, when you say that on this chart, the divided kingdoms of Alexander's, that has nothing to do with the divided kingdom of Judea and Israel in the early part of the Old Testament, right?
No. It's just the same terminology. So after the Babylonian captivity, so Babylon was that first empire, then comes Medo-Persia, and then comes Greece. So those are the major empires. When we get to Greece, the large horn, that's Alexander the Great. He conquers the whole known world. He has the entire massive empire, and then that kingdom is divided up into four different sections after he dies. That's all that means by the divided kingdom. Let's see here. This next section is these four movements. This next section we're going to go through, the four movements. This is the era of history which we're going to detail the coming conflicts that would develop between two of those four divisions, namely the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire. And these are identified as the kings of the south and the kings of the north. So, and that's in relation to their geographical relation to Israel. So the north of Israel is the kings of the north, and that's really north and east with the Seleucid Empire. And then the king of the south is all the Ptolemaic kings that come, because they're south of Israel. So here is a chart that sort of outlines this for us, but I'm not going to get into this chart because there's a better chart that we're going to get to. But I wanted to show you just this one, just the top section there. It goes through it labels the first Syrian war, second Syrian war, all these Syrian wars all the way down to the sixth. But there's, another chart we're going to go through that's a little bit more helpful than this one. But I just wanted you to see that the labeling of those wars there. So the king of the north, Seleucus, he's one of those four generals, and his descendants they'll eventually become stronger than Ptolemy and the kings in the south, even though the Ptolemies control the land of Israel for quite a while. Each line continues through many successors, and again, only the most important of which are really detailed here. So a number of generations are we're not going to really focus on, but the major developments and the major trends are outlined in this chapter. So let's read through this section. Again, there's a lot of detail that we could go into. There's a lot of detail that we're going to go into, but there's a lot more that we could. But like I mentioned, the overview and the message being conveyed is really what's the most important. And there's probably, like I said, there's more detail than we have time for and more than you can really take notes on. So maybe just try to track with us as we go. Follow along on the chart that I gave you, the separate chart there. This is the one we're going to kind of focus on the rest of the time. And so keep track of where we are by the verses on the left-hand side. Okay, so that's how we'll keep track of which kings we're talking about and which period. Again, this is a lot of history. And so we're going to try to describe it as we go. Yeah, if you don't have that chart, make sure you grab one of those in the back, because that's going to be where we're going to focus the rest of the time. Okay, so verse 5. Let's jump into this section. It says, "Then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. After some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power. But she will be given up, along with those who brought her in, and the one who sired her as well, as he who supported her in those times." So what is this talking about? So this describes some of the early exploits between these two kingdoms, the Ptolemies in Egypt, the Seleucids in Syria. So in 249 B.C., the king of the south, Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, and you can see that on the chart under next to verse 6, so that we're talking about Antiochus II and then all the way over to Ptolemy II. You can see the arrows going back and forth there that show the direction of these battles and whatnot. So Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, sent his daughter, Berenice, to the king of the north, Antiochus II, Theos. And you can see on that chart there next to verse 6, that's where we're looking. So his plan was to stop the war that was raging, the second Syrian war, and unite the two kingdoms through marriage. Unfortunately, this plan had a flaw, as Antiochus II in the north was already married. However, because he knew that if he did marry Ptolemy II's daughter, it would ensure peace and allow him to gain back a lot of the region that his father had lost to the king of the south before him. So Antiochus II in the north divorced his wife, Laodice, and married Berenice. Berenice persuaded him to reject Laodice's children and set up her own children to succeed him on the throne. However, just after this, back in Egypt, Ptolemy II died, who had sent the daughter north. So Antiochus II, he reneged on the marriage to Berenice and left her and her infant son, and he returned to his previous wife, Laodice, who you can imagine she was not all that thrilled with her husband anymore. So she had him murdered through poison and convinced her son, Seleucus Callinicus, to kill both Berenice and her son from the south. And so the prophecy, this happened just as the prophecy said it would happen. Ptolemy, the king of the south, and his daughter Berenice, and Antiochus II, king of the north, all lost in their struggle for power. Okay, so that's a little bit of the history around that one. So we're going to do that as we go through to try to explain a little bit what this terminology means. So, verse 7, "But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come up against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north. And he will deal with them and display great strength. Also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity to Egypt. And he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years." So Ptolemy the third, Euergetes, who was the eldest son of Ptolemy the second, who had just died in the south, and he was the brother of Berenice, he wasn't very happy about the murder of his sister, so he came north and to invade the Seleucid Empire. And so he did. He defeated the armies of this new king of the north, Seleucus II. And he achieved victory all the way from the coasts of Asia Minor all the way to the Tigris River. So Ptolemy III here captured and put to death Laodice, that previous wife who wasn't happy with her husband. And he was also able to enter Seleucia, the port, a city on the Tigris River, and leave a garrison there. So during this third Syrian war, Ptolemy III is credited with recovering many of the sacred statues that they had lost way back in the Persian period under Cambyses that he carried off during their conquest of Egypt like 300 years earlier. So because of this, he was given the title Euergetes, benefactor. So Ptolemy III, again, you see that next to 7 through 9 there. He acquired much gold and silver during his campaigns. And he outlived Seleucus II, who died from falling off his horse. He outlived him by 4 or 5 years. There's an alternate reading that says at the end of that section that he had outlived the other king. So that's just a note on that. In this next section, in verses 10 through 19, God reveals events that show us how Syria, this kingdom of the north, will begin to get an upper hand over Egypt. And in doing so, we can get control of the Holy Land. And that's going to set up the stage for these persecutions in Israel under Antiochus Epiphanes later. So verse 9 says, "Then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. His sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. The king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former." So, in 240 BC, the king of the north, Seleucus II, again, you still see that on lines 7 through 9, or verses 7 through 9 there, he tried to retaliate and invade Egypt. However, he had to return in defeat because his fleet was destroyed in a storm. The sons of Seleucus II, it mentions here in verse 10, they were Seleucus III, Seranos, which means thunder, and Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great. And he's the father of Antiochus Epiphanes. We're going to talk about him quite a bit. So Seleucus III, the eldest son, he began a war against the Egyptian forces that were already up in Asia Minor. However, he was unsuccessful, and he was assassinated by a member of his army in 223 BC. So then his younger brother, Antiochus III, who was later called Antiochus the Great, he took the throne at age 18 after his brother's death. So it says here that one of the sons will keep coming and will pass through. And that's going to be Antiochus III here. In 219 and 218 BC, he victoriously battled his way all through Judea, coming all the way down to the borders of Egypt. And here he met Ptolemy IV, Philopater, at the Battle of Raphia, also known as the Battle of Gaza, in 217 BC. So it says here that he had a great multitude. So Antiochus III, the king of the north, did have a great multitude. He had 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry. He had 103 war elephants. But Ptolemy IV, the king of the south, was still victorious over him. So Antiochus III was forced to withdraw back into Lebanon. Verse 12, "When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up and will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail." Verse 12 is interesting because it makes reference to another time when God protected his temple from being defiled. Apparently, he was so lifted up by his victory, this is Ptolemy IV in the south, that he stopped by Jerusalem on his way back to Egypt to sacrifice to the God of Egypt. God of Israel. And while he was there, he actually tried to enter into the Holy of Holies, but he was struck down with paralysis, and so he was unable to do so. And this made him so angry that when he got back to Egypt, he actually killed 40,000 Jews in Alexandria. And because of this, many of his own nation really turned against him. So it says in verse 12 there that he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. So again, that's some of the history surrounding that. So let's take a break, maybe 10 minutes or so, and we'll come back and try to, again, struggle our way through the rest of this history. There's a lot of details here. Okay. So, down in verse 13, it says, "For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, and after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones from among your people who will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. Then the king of the north will come, cast up a siege ramp, and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand." So even though Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great from the north, he was defeated in his first go-around trying to capture Egypt, according to the historian Polybius, he even lost 10,000 troops in that first battle. So he began to raise up a larger army, And what was helped, he was helped by the fact that Ptolemy the Fourth in the south, he didn't really, he did little to cement his earlier victory. Rather, he tried to just make peace with Antiochus. And according to Polybius, he said, abandoned himself to a life of dissolution that eventually helped fan the flames of unrest in Egypt. So he eventually died. His son, infant son Ptolemy the Fifth, you see there under, I guess that's Ptolemy Epiphanes, I think that it is. Yeah, no, 15 and 16. Next to 15 and 16 on the far right, Ptolemy Epiphanes. So he, under a regent, because he was only a young child, under a regent, Agathocles, he then followed Ptolemy the Fourth. So now we see after spending about 14 years enlarging his kingdom up in the north, Antiochus III, he finally saw a new opportunity to avenge himself against the Egyptians. And so, like it says here in verse 13, after forming a league with the king of Macedonia, Philip V, he recaptured the southern part of Syria and invaded Judah. And after an initial setback in 200 BC, he finally defeated the Egyptians under their general Scopas at Peneus, near the headwaters of the Jordan. The Egyptians then retreated to the coastal fortress of Sidon, which Antiochus then besieged. Scopas and his troops eventually were starved into surrender, and he and his troops were allowed to leave the city naked after giving up their weapons. So that was interesting. So Antiochus III occupied the territory, finally, that was once occupied by Israel. Okay, again, this is going to set up this coming persecution under his son, Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. So the king of the north had once and for all conquered the Holy Land and taken it from the king of the south. But notice here it says in verse 14, it says, many violent ones from among your people will rise up. And this is one of the places we see this anticipation of the end, where they revolted, thinking that the end had come, but it had not yet arrived. That's one of the verses that mentions that. Verse 16, it says, but he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. He will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. All right, so Antiochus III, by this time he's called Antiochus the Great because of his triumphs in the east, he was powerful enough to do what he wanted. However, he was aware of the growing threat from Rome. So again, this is near the end of the Greek Empire when Rome is on the rise. So he was aware of this growing threat from Rome, so he made an alliance with this new young king, Ptolemy V, down in the south, who was actually... And he gave him his daughter Cleopatra, who was still a child, to be his wife. Now, this isn't the same Cleopatra as Antony and Cleopatra. This is about five Cleopatras earlier. But you see that she came from up in Syria. She wasn't Egyptian. So she came down, and then this Cleopatra, right. But then she married Ptolemy the Fifth, and then they had children, and then about five Cleopatras later is the one that Antony and Cleopatra with Rome and all that. But even though Antiochus the Great gave his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy the Fifth in the south, she actually became loyal to Ptolemy the Fifth against her father. And she supported a treaty between Egypt and Rome against her father Antiochus. So as Daniel was told here, the marriage turned out to be of no help to Antiochus in furthering his political and territorial gains in Egypt. So now we see Rome is on the rise, and this is going to be important coming up here shortly. Verse 18 says, then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So he will turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more. So these coastlands, this is interesting. In 192, Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great, is so ambitious, he crosses over into Greece and it says to aid the Aetolians. I guess that was a group over there. He then sent ambassadors to Rome to ask for friendship. However, the Roman Senate replied that they would only be friends with him if he allowed Greece to be free and independent, and he kept his paws off of Europe. He refused, Antiochus refused, and he went to war against Rome. And he had, with 10,000 men, he sailed across the Aegean, and he took some strongholds in Asia Minor. But in doing so, he alienated his former ally, the Macedonian king, Philip V. The Roman army then entered Asia Minor and defeated Antiochus III at the Battle of Magnesia in 190 BC. Then the Romans, they set a high cost on Antiochus for this battle. It says that they demanded 20 hostages, including his son, Antiochus IV. This is going to later be Antiochus Epiphanes. So he was just a young son at that point. And so they required him to be sent to Rome as a hostage, along with 20 others, and that he reduce his naval ships down to 12, and then he pay Rome for the cost of the battle, which was 15,000 talents over the next 12 years. So Antiochus III's pride had finally brought defeat to the kingdom of the north. As a consequence of this Roman victory over Antiochus the Great, the outlying provinces, because the Seleucid Empire was pretty large, these outlying provinces started to rebel against him. And so his kingdom was now reduced to just Syria and Mesopotamia and western Iran. So he was in great need of funds to pay back Rome for this battle. And so in 187 BC, he was attempting to plunder a pagan temple in Babylon, near Susa, and he was murdered. And so it says, like it says here, he was found no more. Then in his place, verse 20, it says, "Then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Yet within a few days he will be shattered, though not in anger nor in battle. In his place a despicable person." Who do you think that's going to be? Antiochus Epiphanes, right? "A despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue." So Antiochus III's eldest son, Seleucus IV, Philopater, you see him there under next to verses 10 through 14 there on the chart. He took over after Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great's death. But because of this heavy debt burden imposed by Rome, he had to overly tax his empire. And this included heavy taxation on the people of Israel. In fact, he even sent his treasurer, Heliodorus, to the temple in Jerusalem to try to get money from the actual temple. So right at this time, the Roman Senate, they decided to trade hostages with this Seleucid king. So they ordered this Seleucus IV to send his young son Demetrius, who was the actual heir to the throne, to Rome. In return, the Romans returned Seleucus IV's younger brother, Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. And after he was released, he went to Athens for a time. So in 175 BC, after this young Demetrius has been sent off to Rome, Seleucus IV was poisoned by his own minister, Heliodorus. And some historians believe that this was because he desired the throne for himself, and others thought that his newly freed younger brother, Antiochus, eventually Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, who was in Athens, that he was behind the murder. So, with Seleucus IV dead, the rightful heir to the throne was this young Demetrius, who was a captive in Rome. But when Antiochus IV heard about this, he quickly sailed to Pergamum and made a deal with the king of Pergamon, and through flattery, he received his backing. So he arrived in Seleucia with a powerful ally, and he stopped Heliodorus' plans on acquiring the throne. So he became co-regent with now a younger son and became his protector. But then in 170 BC, this younger son was murdered while Antiochus was out of town. And so he really took sole possession of the throne at that point. So it says, like it says in his verses, he seized the kingdom by intrigue. So we finally come to the rise of this king, Antiochus IV, that we discussed so much back in chapter 8, Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 22, "The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. All right, so because of his ability to charm the people and ally himself with them, Antiochus Epiphanes was able to overcome all of these threats to his throne. The prince of the covenant that's referenced here is the Jewish high priest Ananias III. And he was the high priest at the time that Antiochus came to power. And he was fiercely opposed to Antiochus, his efforts to Hellenize, to make Greek, basically, all of his lands. And so Ananias' brother, named Joshua, he actually had gone along with all these Hellenizing efforts. And so he approached Antiochus and said, you know, I'll give you this huge bribe. Let's overthrow my brother and make me the high priest. And so he made this deal with him. And he changed his name to Jason. And Jason told him that he would pay this large bribe to make him high priest. So they forced Ananias out, and Jason was installed as high priest in 174 B.C. Then a couple years later, Jason sent a priest named Menelaus to Antiochus with his tribute money. However, Menelaus took Jason's bribe money, added some more money to his own, of his own, and bribed Antiochus to make him the high priest, even though he wasn't the high priest of the high priestly tribe. So Menelaus then returned to Jerusalem and deposed Jason, who fled for his life. And he's going to come back in the picture in a little bit. So Antiochus's his double cross of Jason shows his true character. He was all about the money. So then, once again, this king of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes, he set his sights on the kingdom of the south. In Egypt, the 14-year-old Ptolemy the VI, Philometor, he is where are we? Let's see. Hang on a second. Let me see where we're at. Ptolemy the VI. Yeah, he's not listed there. But maybe that would be just after Ptolemy Epiphanes. Yeah, he's not listed there. So he, let's see. Ptolemy the VI. He was that young. One, I guess he has since gone away. So, okay. So this 14-year-old Ptolemy the VI had become king, and he was actually the nephew of Antiochus the IV. His mother Cleopatra was Antiochus the IV's sister. So Antiochus the IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, he sought an alliance with his young nephew down in Egypt. And so he moved through Syria and Judea with a small army, trying to keep, you know, not to arouse suspicion. But he came down to seize Egypt. His cover story was that he was coming to act as protector of his nephew, Ptolemy the VI. Yeah. Yes. It's all the divisions of the Greek Empire.
Okay, so Ptolemy is not Egyptian. It was Greek to start with.
He was Greek, and they took over the Egyptian region, so it's Greeks running that empire.
Oh, okay.
And so that all comes mixed together, and that's what the Egyptians really came to be.
Was Epiphanes a title, or was it actually a name?
He took on the title Epiphanes, which means made manifest. So he's basically saying he's God made manifest. So he's Antiochus IV. And he's going to be the one that's really in view for the rest of the time here. Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay. So this Antiochus Epiphanes really was a strange character. I mean, instead of calling him Epiphanes, which means made manifest, some people called him Epimenes, which means madman. There's a short section from a historian Polybius that's kind of interesting. I'll just go through it real quick. He says, escaping from his attendance at court, he would often, this is Antiochus Epiphanes, he would often be seen wandering about in all parts of the city with one or two companions. He was chiefly found at the silversmith's and the goldsmith's workshop, holding forth at length and discussing technical matters with the molders and other craftsmen. He used to also condescend to converse with any common people he met and used to drink in the company of the meanest foreign visitors to Antioch. Whenever he heard that any of the young men were at an entertainment, he would come in quite unceremoniously with a fife and a procession of musicians, so that most of the guests got up and left in astonishment. He would frequently put off royal robes and, assuming a white toga, go round the marketplace like a candidate, and taking some by the hand and embracing others, he would beg them to give him their vote, like he was running for something, sometimes for the office of aedile and sometimes for that of tribune. Upon being elected, he would sit upon the ivory curule chair, as is the Roman custom, listening to the lawsuits tried there and pronouncing judgment with great pains and display of interest. In consequence, all respectable men were entirely puzzled about him, some looking upon him as a plain, simple man and others as a madman. His conduct, too, was very similar as regards the presents he made. To some people he used to give gazelle's knuckle bones, to others dates, and to others money. Knuckle bones. Occasionally, he used to address people he had never seen before when he met them and make them the most unexpected kind of presents. So he really was a strange character. Verse 24 says, in a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. So what he did was he put in really a kind of a unique plan for gaining control over Egypt. He had, again, he had taken this small army down there trying to protect his nephew. So he moved into parts of the kingdom that were the richest, and then he did something that no Seleucid king had ever done. He spread around some of his spoils of war to the people. First Maccabees says that he spent much on the public. It is even reported that he would go into the streets and throw money to the citizens there. So, but this was just the beginning of the plan. He also visited the strongholds, the strongest areas of the area, to find out their power. And so in 170 BC, when he finally felt secure about the state of his own kingdom, he decided to take Egypt by force, which is known as the Sixth Syrian War. So again, they're just going back and forth and back and forth. So this is Antiochus Epiphanes. He regarded Ptolemy IV, his nephew, as a weak ruler, and therefore he didn't think that he was able to successfully stand against him in war. So Antiochus IV moved his army down to the border of Egypt, which is near the Nile Delta. And the Egyptians had a large army arrayed there against him. And Antiochus, risking death, he rode straight into the middle of the Battle of Pelusium, and he ordered the Egyptians to be taken alive instead of slain. And so by this policy, he somehow gained control over, he won the battle and gained control over Pelusium and later took Memphis. So he had control of the south now. Let's just go through this. Keep going through this. Verse 26 says, those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. So the nephew, Ptolemy VI in the south, his army, although large, wasn't able to withstand Antiochus IV. And who had actually corrupted some of the ministers of Egypt through bribes. And so he was able to again, defeat them through chicanery. So then, after he took control of Pelusium and Memphis, he set his sights on Alexandria. And again, through bribery and other things, he had corrupted some of the officials, and the Alexandrians had renounced their allegiance to this nephew, King Ptolemy VI, and set up his younger brother, Ptolemy VII, as king. And so there are these two brothers that were vying for power down in the south, and Antiochus sort of played them off each other. Let's just keep going. Verse 28 says, then he will return to his land, this is Antiochus, with much plunder, But his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. So here he starts this massive persecution of the Jews that we had talked about back in chapter 8. While he was down in Egypt, a false rumor had arisen up in Judea that he had been killed. And so this prompted that deposed priest Jason to come back and attack Jerusalem. He took raised an army of 1,000 men, and he captured Jerusalem and forced Menelaus to take refuge in the Acra fortress in Jerusalem. And so when Antiochus heard about this, he thought that Judea was in revolt against him. So he came back from Egypt and marched against Jerusalem, and he commanded his soldiers to kill everyone they encountered, men, women, and children. And within the space of 3 days, they had killed somewhere between 40 and 80,000 people. And then a similar number were taken and sold into slavery. And so then he also, not satisfied with this slaughter, he took, he entered the temple guided by Menelaus, and he took the holy vessels and the golden altar and the menorah and the table of showbread and the cups for the offerings and the bowls and the golden censers and the curtain and the crowns and all that stuff. And he took all the hidden treasures, and then he appointed the Phrygian Philip as governor in Jerusalem. And then he returned to Antioch. So that explains those verses there. Verse 29 says, at the appointed time, he will return, come into the south, but this last time it will not turn out the way it did before, for ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So while this is all happening up in Jerusalem, down in the south, the two brothers actually reconciled and decided to share power. That's talking about where he's going to come and attack the law of God and set up the whole abomination of desolations. So that's what is going to happen in just a second. But he's going to go back down to Egypt to try one more time. So the two brothers, Ptolemy the 6th and 7th down in south, they reconciled and decided to fight against him. So in 168 B.C., Antiochus IV, once again, he decided to go down to war against Egypt. But because they knew they couldn't defeat Antiochus alone, they appealed to Rome for help. And so the Romans agreed to provide assistance. The ships from Kittim, the phrase here, refers to ships which brought the Roman legions to Egypt in fulfillment of this defense pact. So when Antiochus IV comes down, he is met by these three Roman senators led by Gaius Popilius Lenaeus near Alexandria. And there, the Roman ambassadors, they delivered to Antiochus the Senate's demand that he withdraw from Egypt. And when the king was, he sort of asked for time to think about it, Popilius drew a circle around Antiochus in the dirt and told him not to leave the circle until he gave his answer. The king of the north here was so astonished at this Roman arrogance, he was kind of shocked, but he finally did agree and said he would do all that the Romans demanded. So this really was an event that marked the end of the Greek Empire and the beginning of Roman dominance. And it also gave us the expression, drew a line in the sand. That's where that came from. So Antiochus then, he was humiliated, and he returned back up north, and he was so outraged at this humiliation, he took out his frustration on the Jews. So he had already killed a bunch of them, but now he's so frustrated. So his armies encircled Jerusalem and then attacked, and then all the Jews who resisted were executed, except for the pro-Hellenistic Jews who went along with his Hellenizing program. Verse 31, and we get to the abomination of desolations here. Verse 31, forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. And they will set up the abomination of desolation. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. So again, this is the abomination of desolations, which gives us this preview, a picture of what the Antichrist will eventually do. And we're entering a section here where we're going to transition away from talking about the immediate historical situation of Antiochus and sort of jump to talking about the end times and what the Antichrist is going to do. That's going to come in this next section here. So Antiochus, like we talked about before, in chapter 8, his army desecrated the temple. They stopped the daily sacrifices. They built a pagan altar over the altar of the temple and put an image of Zeus on it. And they offered a pig as a sacrifice on the altar to Zeus. So after venting his anger upon the Jews, he wanted to make the entire kingdom one people. And so he ordered them to give up their own customs, and that included the Jews. He refused to let them read the law of God. No sacrifices were to be offered in the sanctuary. The Sabbath was profaned. The Jews were not allowed to circumcise their sons. Under the threat of death, they were commanded to give up their beliefs so that eventually the law would be forgotten. And he also appointed inspectors to watch the Jews and to see if they obeyed. Whenever Antiochus' men found copies of the Torah, they tore it into little pieces and they burned it. And whoever was found in possession of the Torah was put to death. And any women who had their children circumcised were put to death, along with the whole family and those who circumcised them. But still, many in Israel chose to die rather than to break this covenant. Again, we talked about that in a great deal of length before. Verse 34 says, "Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time." So right about this time, we see the Maccabean revolt. Okay, once they sacrificed the pig on the altar and all that, they revolted. And Judas Maccabeus led this revolt and overthrew the Seleucids at this point. So that's when they lost their control of Israel. Then the Gentile nations around Judea, when they heard that the Seleucids had been overthrown, they actually became angry with the Jews and persecuted them. So Judas Maccabeus then took his army out and started to defend the Jews out in these other areas as well. All right, so beginning with after Judas Maccabeus died, Mattathias's leadership, under his leadership, the rule of these Hasmoneans lasted from 168 B.C. all the way down to 37 B.C., well into the Roman era. But again, here, we see mentioned that it is not yet the time of the end. So in this next verse, that's where we transition from this third sort of period to the fourth period, where the language begins to go beyond just the immediate historical situation of Antiochus and focus more on the end times. And again, this is the nature of apocalyptic prophecy. We saw several examples of this in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, where he was talking about the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon, but then the language went beyond their situation and talked about the power behind them. So that's kind of what's going on here. So verse 36, it says, "Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done." Commentator David Guzik, he notes on this section, he says, "Here we shift from what was fulfilled in the Ptolemaean Seleucids to what will be fulfilled in the Antichrist, the final world dictator. Daniel was told that this revelation pertained to the latter days and begins to look more towards the final world dictator, who is sort of a last days Antiochus Epiphanes. We know that everything about this prophecy was not fulfilled during the career of Antiochus Epiphanes. Jesus said specifically that the real abomination of desolation was still in the future." So it says here that in this verse that the king will exalt himself above every god. And that's almost word for word what it says about the Antichrist in 2 Thessalonians 2:4, which says that we've read this many times, that he will exalt himself above every so-called god or that is worshipped. But Antiochus, though, he exalted himself, but he always remained loyal to the Greek gods. So this again, goes beyond his particular situation. Antiochus put an image of Zeus in the temple, but the Antichrist is going to set himself up in the temple as God and be worshipped there. This verse also calls him the king. It doesn't say the king of the north or king of the south like it has all the way through. This is just the king. So again, this goes beyond just the immediate historical situation. And we saw, you know, at length how the 10 kings and the 10 whores rise up in the last days, and this Antichrist is to be one of those last kings. Daniel 9 also calls him the prince who is to come. And then finally it says here that he will prosper until the indignation is finished. This indignation is the tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble. It's the time of the outpouring of God's wrath on the earth, and specifically upon Israel during the last half of the tribulation period. So this is probably a good place to pause and pick up the rest next time. There's not much of this history left. Most of it really is focusing on the end times now. So we made it through all this detailed history. I know it was challenging. So we'll finish up chapter 11 and then go through chapter 12 next time and see then, you know, not only the end of the book of Daniel, but a description of the end of days as well. Yeah. I think he basically just transcribed what the angel told him. So I don't think there's some language in there that gives the impression that he would understand that this pertains to the end times. But I don't know if he would be able to distinguish between the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the end time. Because there's that gap, that missing, hidden gap that we always see in the Old Testament when it talks about this church age. And so I don't think he could necessarily distinguish between those two. But I think he understood that he was talking about the end times. Because then the language in chapter 12 just goes, I mean, it's the Ancient of Days and the setting up of the kingdom and all this glorious stuff. So that's pretty clear. So, any other questions? I know there was a lot of historical stuff to kind of slog our way through. So, yeah. In really any commentary that talks about Daniel, all this stuff is really well documented through the first and second Maccabees and other Roman histories as well. It's a lot to try to like slug our way through. This is actually really helpful to kind of keep track of what, you know, kingdom is fighting what kingdom and whatnot. You really don't need to get into all the details about this kingdom going south and this going north and all that kind of stuff and whose daughter married who. It's just the main message that there's these three movements, four movements, and the first three aren't quite the end yet. And then the fourth movement, which we're just starting to get into, is a description of the end. And Antiochus previews that for us, and so then we'll see what that looks like next time. So, all right, let's close in prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for this time. We thank you for your revelation of yourself. We thank you for the ability to marvel at just the precision with which you gave these prophecies to Daniel hundreds of years before they took place, and how you provided your people with hope to know that you would be there with them all the way through, that you would provide for them and help them survive through to the end, Lord. And help us to take that as hope as well, that we know you are in control, you are sovereign, and that nothing happens without your permission, Lord. Just go with us as we leave this place, Lord, and help us to keep our eyes focused squarely on you. We love you and praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.